following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight with Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
All right, happy Wednesday, everyone. Well, happy unless perhaps you're in the Virgin Islands or Puerto Rico. Or Mexico City. It's amazing. If I were still playing pre-show music, it would have been It's the End of the World as We Know It today, because it seems like the world is falling around all around us, from earthquakes in Mexico. It's devastating, to this Hurricane Maria just hit Puerto Rico head on. The reports are the entire island is without power. The entirety of Puerto Rico is without power. And the storm hasn't even cleared the island yet. It's, the worst of it, I think, is over, but they're still being, battered with these hurricane force winds and rains. And I feel so terrible for those people down there. And then there's the rest of the world, especially those of us here in the United States who are being led by, this orange cretin in the White House who thinks it's acceptable to go before world leaders on the world stage at the United Nations, call another world leader Rocket Man because he thinks his nicknames are oh so cute, and threaten to annihilate a whole country. This is where we are. And if you feel like you haven't had a day without stress since November 8th, it's because you haven't. Let alone what's happening in your personal life. This is just being out, just watching the news, just watching what's going on in the world. We are all, and I'll speak for myself first, stressed to the max. So if you're in that boat, I want to invite you to be listening on Friday. On Friday, Kelly Carlin will be here. Kelly Carlin, daughter of George Carlin. Yes, the great, amazing comedian, who, in addition to being a funny woman herself, is a certified therapist counselor. She did a thing over the summer, a webinar to help people sort of unplug and de-stress and get away from it and rechannel their focus. And she's about to start on her second session of these things. So hopefully she can give us all a little advice, because I know I can certainly use it. The latest thing I'm stressing over, of course, is this zombie attempt to kill the Affordable Care Act. Just when we thought we were safe, right, comes along Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy. And, it's close. No matter how you slice it, it's close. They will have either 48, 49, or 50 votes. That's just the way it is. And to be honest, last night I was freaking out a little bit. And I'm checking my email, and I see an email from Ryan Grimm. It's not a personal email to me. He writes a newsletter that you really should subscribe to. But Ryan Grimm, formerly of the Huffington Post, he's now Washington bureau chief for The Intercept. And I want to share with you the email he wrote, because it's the most calming explanation of what's going on that I've read. Now, this is not to say that anything is okay. This is not to say to stop calling. This is not to say don't be on high alert, because you know what they do in Washington, the way they twist arms and they cut deals and they buy people off. Anything can happen. But if you need a bit of a calming influence to know that maybe it's not as dire as it sounds, let me share with you what Ryan Grimm wrote in his newsletter. He wrote, "It's often said about politics that perception is reality. As true as that can often be, sometimes reality manages to break through. And that appears to be what's happening this week to the latest effort by Senate Republicans to repeal and replace Obamacare. After several weeks of trying, the bill's authors, Senators Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy, weren't any closer to getting the 50 votes they needed to pass the measure by the deadline of September 30th. Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, and John McCain hadn't budged, and Rand Paul had added himself to the no column. So Graham and Cassidy bluffed and began telling the press they were extremely close. Their whip counts had them right there within striking distance. Democrats and progressive groups responded with a full-scale mobilization in defense, and all of a sudden, we were shooting with real bullets again, except we weren't. While McCain, a good friend of Graham's, is a question mark, none of the others have shown any signs of wobbling. Without those three, Republicans are short of the votes. Yes, having 49 votes is close, but it's no closer than they were in July when the effort died last time. Much of the focus has been on Murkowski, who just a few weeks ago told her summer interns that helping block repeal last time was the greatest difference-making vote she'd ever cast, something she'd done on principle. It's hard to imagine how she moves from there to the other side, but even if it were possible, Ryan Grimm writes, today made it that much less likely. Now, again, he wrote this yesterday, so I'll change the tense. So yesterday morning, Alaskan Press reported that the Republican governor was thumbs down on Graham Cassidy. After all, a quarter of the state relies on Medicaid. Then around lunchtime, he signed a letter with other governors urging the state not to act on Graham Cassidy. That led to an unusual experience for me, writes Ryan Grimm. The chance to inform Graham himself that the Alaska governor, the man he needed to help persuade Murkowski to come on board, had come out against his bill. After Senate Republicans had lunched with Vice President Mike Pence to chart the path forward, Ryan Grimm asked Lindsey Graham if he was disappointed in the governor's announcement and whether he had spoken with him beforehand. It quickly became clear that this was the first time he was hearing about it. When was the announcement? He asked, adding that he doesn't know the governor personally. Later, Murkowski explained to reporters the crux of the governor's objection. It wasn't about ideology or conservative politics. It was about the cuts in health care spending. In other words, it was about reality. I get half as much money. If I get half as much money, flexibility doesn't help me, Murkowski said, that her governor explained, a nugget of policy wisdom folks might want to keep close at hand. With Collins and Paul presumed no votes, Republicans can't lose Murkowski. Unless a political earthquake hits, they already have. So that's what Ryan Grimm wrote, which makes me feel not quite so grim, as it were, but still a little nervous. So don't let up. 202-224-3121 is the number to the Senate switchboard. You call there, you ask for your senator's office, especially if you are in Alaska, in Arizona, in Maine, in Ohio, in Colorado, in Utah, in Texas, because John McCain, Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins, Rob Portman, Cory Gardner, Mike Lee, and Ted Cruz, none of them have publicly said how they'll vote. So those are the ones who are most likely still on the fence. But hey, call your senators too. It doesn't matter. They need to hear from you. Tammy Baldwin tweeted out that her phone's been ringing off the hook. Now, that's a good thing. We know how she's going to vote, but it doesn't hurt to have them hear from us. This is the worst of all of the repeal and replace bills. It would end Medicaid expansion as we know it, 15 million fewer people on Medicaid. It ends protections for pre-existing conditions, which affects 52 million Americans. It ends protections against lifetime limits. Essential health benefits would no longer be mandatory. It ends the mandate for companies with more than 50 employees to provide health care for their employees. This could affect each and every one of us and in a really bad way. So although Ryan Grimm made me feel a little better, I'm not quite there yet. It ain't over till it's over, and it ain't over till September 30th. And then they can start again. But at least, you know, we have won another round, and that's what we need. All right, we're going to hear from Ellen Ratner, and then John Nichols of The Nation will be with us. He's got a new book called Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse. That's not easy to say. I've got a lot to ask him about. So stick around. It's a busy Wednesday here on The Nicole Sandler Show. We'll be right back.
I read the news today. Oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
As of Wednesday morning, the death toll is already at 217 and expected to keep rising from a powerful 7.1 magnitude earthquake that struck central Mexico Tuesday afternoon on the 32nd anniversary of a devastating quake that killed thousands in Mexico City in 1985. In the Caribbean, Hurricane Maria made direct impact at around 6:15 Wednesday morning on Puerto Rico, the first Category 4 or stronger storm to strike the island since 1932, and the second to hit the Caribbean this month. Maria already tore through Guadalupe and devastated the tiny island nation of Dominica. Republicans are working feverishly to jam a last-minute repeal of the Affordable Care Act through the Senate, but they're facing growing opposition from healthcare groups, patient advocates, and a bipartisan group of governors who signed on to a letter saying the bill would upend the nation's healthcare system. The Congressional Budget Office says it won't have details or a score for at least several weeks. However, the reconciliation bill under which Graham Cassidy would dismantle Obamacare expires in 10 days. The Cassidy in Graham Cassidy is Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy, who took advantage of late-night comedian Jimmy Kimmel's son's birth defect to propose the Jimmy Kimmel rule a few months back. On Tuesday night, Jimmy Kimmel called out the lies.
So last week, Bill Cassidy and Senator Lindsey Graham proposed a new bill, the Graham Cassidy bill. And this new bill actually does pass the Jimmy Kimmel test, but a different Jimmy Kimmel test. With this one, your child with a pre-existing condition will get the care he needs if and only if his father is Jimmy Kimmel. Otherwise, you might be screwed. I don't know what happened to Bill Cassidy, but when he was on this publicity tour, he listed his demands for a health care bill very clearly. These were his words. He said he wants coverage for all, no discrimination based on pre-existing conditions, lower premiums for middle-class families, and no lifetime caps. And guess what? The new bill does none of those things. Coverage for all? No. In fact, it'll kick about 30 million Americans off insurance. Pre-existing conditions? Nope. If the bill passes, individual states can let insurance companies charge you more if you have a pre-existing condition. You'll find that little loophole later in the document after it says they can't. They can and they will. But will it lower premiums? Well, in fact, for lots of people, the bill will result in higher premiums. And as far as no lifetime caps go, the states can decide on that, too, which means there will be lifetime caps in many states. So not only did Bill Cassidy fail the Jimmy Kimmel test, he failed the Bill Cassidy test. He failed his own test.
Meanwhile, over in the Health, Education, Labor, and Pension, or HELP Committee, senators had been working on their own bipartisan bill to stabilize the Affordable Care Act, written by Republican Lamar Alexander and Democrat Patty Murray. On Tuesday, House Speaker Paul Ryan and the White House came out against it in order to push Graham Cassidy as the only way forward. The 45th President of the United States delivered the keynote address to the United Nations General Assembly Tuesday, vowing to, quote, totally destroy North Korea, reportedly eliciting a few gasps in the room of otherwise stone-faced presidents, prime ministers, monarchs, and diplomats.
Now North Korea's reckless pursuit of nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles threatens the entire world with unthinkable loss of human life. No nation on earth has an interest in seeing this band of criminals arm itself with nuclear weapons and missiles. The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
In addition to overgeneralizing,
major portions of the world are in conflict, and some, in fact, are going to hell.
Trump hammered the Iran nuclear agreement.
We cannot let a murderous regime continue these destabilizing activities while building dangerous missiles, and we cannot abide by an agreement if it provides cover for the eventual construction of a nuclear program. The Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into. Frankly, that deal is an embarrassment to the United States, and I don't think you've heard the last of it. Believe me.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani told NBC's Lester Holt that trust of the United States is at stake if Trump were to pull out.
The exiting of the United States from such an agreement would carry a high cost, meaning that subsequent to such a probable action by the United States of America, no one will trust America again. And there is no higher price to be paid than this, because after such a possible scenario, which country would be willing to sit across the table from the United States of America and talk about international issues? This will mean that it will carry with it the lack of subsequent trust from countries towards the United States, because the greatest capital that any country has is trust and credibility.
And that's just a bit of What's News for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these What's News reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider a contribution, as our work is 100% listener supported. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate. All right, Nicole Sandler back with you. We should be hearing from Ellen Ratner any moment now with a little bit more of the afternoon news. Until then, just a little promo of what's coming up. John Nichols of The Nation will be along in a little while to talk about his new book. See if I can spit it out this time. Horsemen of the Trumpopolis. See, I still can't say it. Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse. If I look at it, I can read it. We'll talk with him about that. I also want to get John Nichols' take on what the president's speech at the UN yesterday, because it was just so horrendous. In fact, in the meantime, while we're waiting for Ellen Ratner to call in, we've got some downtime. If you'd care to weigh in, 954-889-6410 is the number, 954-889-6410. Or you can Skype into Nicole Sandler. I'm still reeling from it. And the more I hear the clips, the more I know it sort of makes your skin crawl. For him to talk about major, like this clip here.
Major portions of the world are in conflict, and some, in fact, are going to hell.
Really? Who's going to hell? Major portions of the world are in conflict, and some, in fact, are going to hell. This is what he says in a speech. One of the things I want to talk with John Nichols about is who wrote this speech. And I said it yesterday that I believe it's Stephen Miller. And Stephen Miller is just a horrible person. He's the one who went on TV and said that that, you know, the end result of this, meaning all the criticisms of the president, is that our opponents, the media, and the whole world will soon see, as we begin to take further actions, that the powers of the president to protect our country are very substantial and will not be questioned. The guy who says the powers of the president will not be questioned is the guy who's writing his speeches, who's all of, 31 years old? This book is, it is creepy, Shalel in the chat room. This book is interesting. It's designed as a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. And it tells you, it's split up into chapters on the different people surrounding President, I can't even say it, the president. You notice I have a hard time putting those two words together. I can't say President so-and-so. They just won't come out. Anyway, all this is coming up. I don't know where Ellen Ratner is, so I'll tell you what we will do. Let me share with you something else. I mentioned we were talking about the healthcare bill. I had yesterday booked somebody to join us tomorrow. Laura Packard will be on with us tomorrow. Well, it turns out that Laura Packard is she is suffering from stage 4 lymphoma, stage 4 cancer. And she lives in Nevada. And in Nevada, her senator, Dean Heller, was one who you might recall the last time there was a health care bill up for, a repeal and replace bill. Dean Heller was one of the ones on the fence. First, he was against it. Then he was for it. Then, of course, they had the dinner at the White House or a lunch or whatever it was. And Trump cajoled him or threatened him into voting for the repeal. And now, you know, he's right there with him. Well, yesterday I read off a list of the 10 governors who had signed the letter to Mitch McConnell saying, do not bring this up for a vote. Sandoval, the governor of Nevada, was one of those. So anyway, Laura Packard has a column in the Las Vegas Sun that she wrote yesterday. So I invited her to come on for a few minutes and talk with us tomorrow, and she will. Today, I see a little blurb from Think Progress that this woman with stage 4 cancer was blocked by Donald Trump. Sure enough, it's our friend Laura Packard. Donald Trump actually blocked her for tweeting at him against this horrendous sham of a bill that they're trying to push through. There will be no CBO score on it. It will do all those things I mentioned before, and then some. I mean, ending protections for pre-existing conditions. Once they do away with the individual mandate, that's the end of coverage for pre-existing conditions. And, I sit here these days, I try not to talk too much about what's going on with me, because enough about me. But as a cancer survivor and somebody who has to go in every 4 months for scans, that's frightening. Because what I'm looking at is in October, perhaps being the final CT scan that I get in my post-cancer existence. If they kill this, and when I talk about me, I'm talking about millions of other people who are living the same reality that I am. It's just not a good one. So have you called your senators yet? I mean, it feels like we've been through this drill so many times, right? But you got to do it. 202-224-3121. 202-224-3121. That is the number for the Senate switchboard. Again, you know, I mentioned McCain, Murkowski, Collins, Portman, Gardner, Lee, Cruz. Someone in the chat room had mentioned, what's her name? Shelley Moore Capito from West Virginia. Now, so much of West Virginia is on Medicaid. This bill would be the worst of all of the repeal and replace, worse than the skinny bill, worse than the first one they put out. And they're trying to push it through again with no score from the CBO. I read something really worrisome. Let me see if I can't find this thing that I retweeted. Okay. With no CBO, this is from Manu Raju of CNN. With no Congressional Budget Office score, Lisa Murkowski says she's relying on data from Trump's HHS. That's from Tom Price's Health and Human Services Department, CMS, Center for Medicare, and CMS is their Medicare department, and her state to decide whether to back health bill per Ryan Nobles. This is really frightening. So since there's going to be no CBO, Lisa Murkowski, possibly the deciding vote, will base her answer, her vote on the trumped up numbers she gets from the Trump administration, who are doing everything they can to cook the books on this, to make this bill go through with no CBO score. It's scary. Also, in the last couple of hours, not only Chris Christie, but AHIP, the American Health Insurers, the health insurance lobby, AHIP, came out against it. Blue Cross Blue Shield came out against it. The Federation of American Hospitals announced they are against it. I mean, when I start getting myself riled up, I think back to the piece I just read to you from Ryan Grimm and think that, okay, I shouldn't get so riled up, that we're in better shape than we know. But the uncertainty of it all. And by the way, the uncertainty of it all is also driving insurers out. This week and next is when they decide, you know, if the bottom line, if they're going to be participating in the exchanges. So their whole goal is to promote uncertainty. Here is, I found Laura's tweet. Oh my God, the president of the United States just personally blocked me. It's incredible. She wrote, she was tweeting back at him. Donald Trump tweeted, I was saddened to see how bad the ratings were on the Emmys last night, the worst ever. Smartest people of them are all the deplorable. So that's Trump, you know, because there's nothing more important in the world for him to be concerned with. He tweets about the Emmys. And Laura Packard shot back with a tweet saying, honey, please, you're not fooling anybody. We know you could never earn your daddy's love, and it eats away at you that Manhattan High Society thinks you're a joke. Well, apparently, that's what did it. That's what made Trump block her, which I don't think he's allowed to do. Anyway, Laura Packard will join us tomorrow. And in a few minutes, we'll speak with John Nichols. I don't know what happened to Ellen Ratner. I'm going to have to call and give her a piece of my mind. But we'll take another quick break. We'll come back on the other side with John Nichols from The Nation right here on The Nicole Sandler Show. Don't go away.
How can we finally get Congress to provide good health care for all of us? Hear about my two-step solution today on Hightower's Radio Lowdown. Want good quality, lower-cost health care for your family? And what the hell? Let's think big here. For every man, woman, and especially every child in our society, here's how we can finally get Congress to pass such a program. Step 1. Take away every dime of the multimillion-dollar government subsidy that members of Congress get to cover their platinum-level health insurance. Let them have to live with the same exorbitantly expensive, dysfunctional, and, let's admit it, sick system of medical profiteering they thrust upon us. Eliminate all of their special treatments, including shutting down their office of the attending physician, a little-known spot of pure 100% socialized medicine, conveniently located in our U.S. Capitol to provide government-paid doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and others who give immediate, on-the-spot attention to these special ones. Well, you might say, they still won't feel the pain because they're one percenters, pulling down $174,000 each from us taxpayers, meaning they can afford to buy decent health insurance. Ah, but here comes step two. Put all of our congressional goof-offs on pay-for-performance salaries. Why pay them a flat rate, whether they produce or not? For example, American babies are one-third more likely to die in their first year of life than babies in Poland, which provides universal health insurance for all of its people. So every year that the U.S. Congress fails to provide health coverage for every American family, the members should get their pay docked by a third. Pay them only when they deliver for the people. This is Jim Hightower saying, when Congress finally assures good health care for all of us, then its members would get the same coverage. But until they deliver for the whole public, the public owes them absolutely nothing.
Need an antidote to the progressive blues? Want some good news about how grassroots folks are rebelling against the corporate powers and winning? Well, here's an easy-to-swallow pill for you, the Hightower Lowdown. Hightower's monthly newsletter will give you the lowdown, even as it lifts you up. It's 4 pages a month, jam-packed with facts you can use, actions you can take, and Jim's own Texas humor, all for only $15 a year. To become a lowdowner, go to HightowerLowdown.org.
The Nicole Sandler Show is 100% listener-supported. Have you given yet? Nicole decided not to put her show behind a paywall, knowing that many can't afford the luxury of paying for a podcast. But if you're able to, she needs your financial support to continue doing this. Consider a monthly subscription. Give when you can. Just visit NicoleSandler.com/donate. Remember, she can't do this without you.
All right, I am back. It is a Wednesday afternoon here on the Nicole Sandler Show, and we are looking for John Nichols.
Hang on one second.
Thank you. So John Nichols is a national affairs writer for The Nation magazine. His work is also read at The Progressive, In These Times, numerous other places. He's authored 10 books, the newest one being...
Oh, hello.
Hi.
He's not here right now.
Oh, you're kidding. I'm supposed to be doing an interview with him. Should I call him on his cell?
Try his cell phone.
Okay. All right. Well, we're having one of those days, aren't we? Let's try John Nichols on his cell phone then. We'll do it that way. Anyway, the new book is Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
Please enjoy this Verizon ringback tone while your party is...
This is John Nichols. Thanks for calling.
And
you've reached my mobile. You can leave a message here, or you can send me an email.
Well,
jnichols@thenation.com.
Okay.
The mailbox is full and cannot accept any messages.
So
at this
we won't
time.
Be leaving
Goodbye.
Him a message either. Well, this leaves me with a bit of a conundrum because I have nothing else prepared. We're going to open up the phones. 954-889-6410. I don't know what else to do, and I have no sound on YouTube. Okay. I'm just batting 1,000 here. Anyway, well, if there's no sound on YouTube, that's okay, YouTube, because John Nichols wasn't there. So we're back. I'm here. Phone lines are open. We can talk about whatever you like. It can be what we do in a world where our elected officials want to take away our health care. It seems like however we turn... They just want to kill us off. YouTube is still not going, huh? Now, YouTube should be back. We'll give it a moment. I know what else I want to share with you. Yeah, YouTube audio is okay now. Yeah, that was a problem on my end, I think. Anyway, so the bottom line is John Nichols is not there, and so we have no guest. So, we have a Congress, a Republican Congress, who wants to take away our health care. Not real encouraging. We have earthquakes hitting Mexico. We have hurricanes hitting the Virgin Islands and the South. It's a scary time in America. And I think we need Kelly Carlin today instead of on Friday. Anyway, let's go to the phones. Hi, who's this?
Mark.
Hey, Mark. Mark in San Francisco, huh?
Yeah, how you doing?
Doing okay.
Yeah.
Except my guests flaked out on me today. What, Mark? John Nichols is calling now, so let me get him, and we'll talk another time. Okay?
Okay.
Thanks a lot. Hello, John Nichols.
Hey, I'm sorry I wasn't immediately available.
No worries. You're here now. John Nichols, as I was telling the listeners, author of many books, the new one being Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse. That's not easy to say. You know that, right?
You know, when I wrote the book, this last thing I thought of was that it would be a challenge to pronounce. Worked really hard on the book for a long time and, talked to people around production and all that. And then I got to the first event, big event at Politics of Pros in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
And the guy who was introducing me said, boy, I've been working really hard on pronouncing this. And it was the first time it occurred to me that, whoa, I see this is difficult. And then when he got up, it wasn't pretty.
Oh, no. You know, what I found is if I'm looking at it, I'm reading it, Trumpocalypse, it's easy. But when I'm just trying to say it from memory, it doesn't roll off the tongue, so to speak.
You know, it really does if you say it enough.
I guess.
And, that's the whole point of our, when you're creating a new word, you start to spread it, it does just fine.
Yes. Well, but John Nichols, before we get to the book, I have to ask you about the president's speech to the UN yesterday, because at The Nation, you called it a, quote, an absurd, bombastic disaster. Care to expand on that? I fully agree, by the way. I mean, jaws dropped. We heard there were gasps in the room when he talked about Rocket Man and destroying the entirety of North Korea. But, Yeah. Did you ever think you would hear a president of the United States say anything like that in that kind of a setting?
Yeah, I did after Trump was elected.
Oh.
But before that, I didn't. look, this speech, much of it written by Stephen Miller, who is still in the White House, still a key aide to the president, somebody I've read a lot about in the book, you know, is a parallel to the inaugural address that President Trump gave. And, you know, frankly, I'm kind of tired of people saying that, you know, President Trump knows how to pull himself together in formal settings. He doesn't. He can't even control himself in, you know, the simplest of places in which to deliver a strong speech. He should have given an inaugural address that tried to unite America. Instead, it was a visceral, divisive, crude speech. Now he goes to the United Nations. It's his most important foreign policy address of the year, the speech that really in many ways defines not at the diplomatic level, but just at the highest level, at the highest profile level, you know, how America speaks to the world. And he's talking about obliterating countries of 25 million people. He's using Elton John song titles.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this was a deeply, deeply flawed speech. And that is not about Republican or Democrat or liberal or conservative or anything like that. This speech was incoherent at times. And to give you one classic example, and one, I think, very important example, in the same speech where he's talking about North Korea and saying that North Korea has to denuclearize, they've just got to end this experiment with nuclear power, nuclear weapons, and you know, obviously suggesting that they have to find an alternative to war, or I would hope he is suggesting that, even though he talks about this total destruction. He later says, just rips it up and is totally negative as regards the Iran deal.
Mm-hmm.
And you understand if you're trying to communicate to people that they've got to negotiate, that they've got to back off a militarized setting. And then you turn around moments later and you say, oh, and by the way, the last people we got to negotiate, you know, I think that was a terrible deal. And though he didn't say as much, indicating the possibility you might rip the deal up.
Yeah.
I mean, this is destructive.
It
is damaging to the country to give a speech like that.
Oh, in every way. The part about the Iranian deal, Lester Holt last night interviewed Iran's president, Rouhani, who said, you know, there will be lots of consequences if he backs out. You know, no one in this world will ever trust the United States for a deal again. I mean, you look at it, pulling out of the Paris Accord, then pulling out of this. Mm-hmm. Who would trust us to do anything? Who would trust this president to do anything?
And this is one of the real vulnerabilities of American democracy, right? We've always known that, you know, any treaty that was arranged is potentially vulnerable to the successor presidents, right? Someone else coming in might choose to alter it or renegotiate it. I mean, that has actually happened historically. But to simply say it's a terrible deal, and to, in some cases, as you say with Paris, to announce your withdrawing, in other cases, to threaten to shred it, it creates a different impression of the United States than this nation has ever sent to the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the strength of this country has been the ability to say that, yes, it's a democracy and power will switch between different parties, different ideologies, but it is a strong democracy that is able to maintain coherent policies, and that if it does have a problem, if the new leaders have a problem with an agreement, they will negotiate, they will, you know, talk, and they will try to put it into perspective. They won't just talk about shredding it or pulling out of it or things like that. And that's the key thing. I'm trying to be a little nuanced here and to suggest that I understand that many of our treaties, our disarmament treaties and others, you know, are in long-term process of negotiation and you know, a back and forth. I recognize the complexities of these things. But if in the heart of the Cold War, we could talk about disarmament and make agreements and at least to some extent make them hold and even extend them. The notion that now we can't do so anymore because Donald Trump is president, that's a horrible, horrible message.
It really is. And the other frightening thing that you allude to in the piece that you wrote for The Nation yesterday in the wake of that speech is the fact that the way the law is written, I guess, or there is no law written, a president has the right when it comes to nuclear weapons to fire first and, I guess, ask questions later.
Well, it's an ill-defined reality at this point, right?
Yeah.
Because nuclear war happens so quickly. And that's, of course, the great terror, the great fear of a nuclear war is that, you know, it's minutes, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes, or people feel there are minutes in which to respond. And so we have a striking lack of definition as regards these issues. And so two very smart, very experienced members of Congress, Ted Lieu in the House of Representatives, who has had a distinguished career in the law and in the military, in and around the military, and Ed Markey, who is one of the experts on nuclear weapons and disarmament in the House and now in the Senate,
mm-hmm.
The two of them have put together bills in which they want Congress to simply say it is the policy of the United States that we don't do first strikes, that we don't send the first bomb, right? We don't start the thing.
Right.
Now, that doesn't take away the ability of a president to defend the United States. And, of course, the United States has tremendous capacity to defend itself. It doesn't take away the ability of the president of the United States to make it clear, you know, that we have the ability to defend ourselves. You know, all of that's still there. It only says that you can't start a nuclear war.
Mm-hmm.
And it's scary and unsettling that members of Congress feel it's necessary to make that point. But I think that after that speech, and talking about total destruction of a country of 25 million people,
yeah,
and really launching, if there was a nuclear war, you know, creating a circumstance on the Korean Peninsula that would affect tens of millions of additional people, maybe many more than that. This is where we live now.
Yes.
And where we live now is very unsettling. And I want to be very clear, not about Democrats and Republicans, not about liberals and conservatives. This is not a fear that you had, you know, with George Bush, the dad, or even, you know, as deeply troublesome as he was with George Bush. You know, this is something very new and very different. It's frankly something I write a lot about in the book. It is my argument that Donald Trump has surrounded himself with and empowered a lot of people who are not conservative Republicans. They are extremists. They're people from the fringe. They're pushing ideas that historically were not considered irrational or acceptable by conservative Republicans. And now these ideas have come to the center of our federal government.
Well, John Nichols, you mentioned Stephen Miller. So let's get back to Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, the new book, A Field Guide to the Most Dangerous People in America. And it is. It's about all the people that Trump has surrounded himself with. And I know there were some of us saying after the unthinkable happened and he won the electoral college vote, that maybe he'll hire good people and he'll surround himself with people who know what they're doing,
sure,
and it won't be so awful. Well, what it seemed is if with each new pick, each one was worse than the last. Let's talk about Stephen Miller, because as far as we know, that's the guy who wrote at least most of that speech. This is his main speech writer, he who will not be questioned. And I guess you took the name of this chapter from mm-hmm. when he went on TV and he asserted that the powers of the president to protect our country are very substantial and will not be questioned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Stephen Miller.
Look, Stephen Miller. Yeah, Stephen Miller has been around for a remarkably long time when you consider he's only 32 years old.
Amazing.
He got heavily involved in politics as a young teenager. And it was always extreme right-wing politics, very, very much on the fringe, with a sense of racial insensitivity, at the very least. That's the kindest way to put it. Antagonism towards Hispanics in his school in Santa Monica, California, and a host of other just rabid right-wing opinions. He came up politically, aligned himself with Jeff Sessions, and then aligned himself with Steve Bannon. He came into the Trump campaign early on. He's very, very close to President Trump. He does write the speeches, but it's also clear he's very much in the inner circle. And what I say about Miller is he's every bit as troubling as Bannon, with more political connections than Bannon. And so when people note that Bannon has left the administration, although I don't think he's really left, I think he's now playing an inside-outside game.
Mm-hmm.
But when they say Bannon has left, I always remind him, you've got just as bad a guy who's right there in the thick of things and continuing to affect our policies. And this is, at the heart of it, this is what I want to communicate and why I wrote the book, is we have to look up and around and beyond Donald Trump's tweets. We have to recognize that, yes, he will say and do horrible things, and he will cause us, many of us, to be very troubled. But at the end of the day, if Donald Trump went to sleep tonight and just stayed asleep for the rest of his term, Rip Van Winkle, the people he has empowered, if they kept rolling forward, they would do almost unimaginable damage to America.
Yes.
To our access to health care, to the protection of our environment, to education, to the always delicate balance between civil society and a military-industrial complex. I mean, so many vital issues, and so little attention is being paid to this. And so what I'm arguing for is a much broader view, and one that takes our resistance and says, yes, of course we'll object when Donald Trump does something wrong, but we will also pay enough attention, tap into the activist groups that are monitoring these different cabinet agencies and regulatory agencies, tap into the media that does do a good job. And in every chapter, I write about folks who are covering these officials and are paying attention to them, and raise a second tier, if you will, of the resistance that says we're against Trump, but we're also against Trumpism. We're against the people who take this power they've been given and are just as extreme or worse than Donald Trump. And if we do not do it, it's possible we'll avoid the apocalypse, which is this, the horrors and fears of something physically destructive. But we may not avert the Trumpocalypse, which is the transformation of America via his appointees into something that is very much a reflection of all the things that we don't like, that we don't want about Donald Trump.
That's very true. The people that he surrounded himself with, and it's weird. The media plays such a strange role, because at times, well, I believe the media was complicit in getting him elected by giving him all the free airtime and ratcheting him up to this better or greater than position. But you know, they almost try to normalize what's going on. John Kelly, I think, is a good example. John Kelly, the secretary of Trump is always right, is how you put him. Now, at the time you were writing the book, he was the secretary of Homeland Security. John Kelly is now chief of staff. And there's a picture that sort of went viral after the speech yesterday of John Kelly with his head in his hands. And almost saying, look, oh, John Kelly, he's so disturbed by what Trump said that, you know, he's in distress. But shouldn't he have known what Trump was going to say? Wouldn't he have read the speech? Wouldn't he know?
Mm-hmm. Well, you would hope that he had read some of it. It is possible that some elements of it, you know, were altered, you know, in the late stages. We are told that Stephen Miller wrote a draft. We don't know what people added and what people subtracted.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the bottom line. It is absurd and frankly embarrassing at this point, for media outlets to talk about John Kelly as somehow stabilizing things in the White House. Since John Kelly, General Kelly, who had an honorable record in many areas, and, you know, who I genuinely think may want to serve his country, but or I genuinely think he does want to serve his country, but, you know, since he's come to the White House, look at what's happened.
Mm-hmm.
We've had the Charlottesville incident and the horrible responses with the president repeatedly returning to the worst possible messages as regards Nazis, fascists, supporters of the Confederacy marching in our streets, killing a young woman.
Yep.
We have had the pardoning of, or the, you know, the wiping away of the criminal charges as regards Sheriff Joe Arpaio.
Yeah.
We have had a ramping up of our nuclear troubles and nuclear concerns. Certainly put the blame on Korea, but, you know, it's hard to see how Donald Trump has done a good job of managing that. It looks to be very much that he has taken a tense situation and in many cases, you know, caused the tensions to at least continue and perhaps grow greater. We have had incoherence as regards domestic policies. We've had as regards the healthcare issue, we had an issue that was supposedly settled. Now it's back again with the president cheering on Mitch McConnell in the worst possible healthcare reform. And at the same time, we've continued to see Donald Trump's appointees and commissions do unimaginably troublesome things, particularly at the EPA with regards to climate change. Even in the aftermath of the horrible storm surges and flooding in Texas and in Florida, now the nightmarish stuff that we're seeing as regards Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. Scott Pruitt at EPA has been running around saying, well, I don't want scientists and all these people stepping up and talking about climate change.
Right. Now's not the time.
I mean, he's continuing this political war on climate science rather than focusing on the core work that he should be doing. And so, you know, with all due respect, if this is the United States under the guidance and with the cautious hand of General Kelly on it, you know, he's not doing enough. It's not working.
You know, it makes me want to say, is there anybody, and I go through the list of names and you have chapters on each one of them, from Nikki Haley to Mike Pompeo to Reince Priebus, the ones who are already gone. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're all in here. It's a very, you know, complete record of who was with this president at the beginning of this historic administration. Is there anybody who is not horrendous?
Well, there's people that are better than others, without a doubt. And, you know, one of the things is that a lot of folks point to the generals, General Mattis, General McMaster, General Kelly, and say, well, you know, these folks, they're the adults in the room. And with all, by any measure, Mattis and McMaster are impressive men who have written extensively on military policy, who've thought about these issues, who have a great deal of respect in the military community. And you don't take that away from them. But the problem is that these adults in the room speak to one side of many of the arguments about war and peace. They are people who favor a hyper-funded, much expanded Pentagon, moving more and more of our resources toward the military and toward the military industrial complex rather than, you know, a balance between militarism, diplomacy, and domestic needs. And, you know, they may be more adult than Donald Trump, but they are not in any way standing up to some of the worst impulses as regards policy. And so with the Trump administration, we have a situation where Rex Tillerson is clearly dialing down and dismantling the State Department, which is the vehicle for diplomacy, foreign aid, many of the alternatives to military responses. At the same time, Mick Mulvaney, the head of the Office of Management and Budget, is proposing budgets that take tens of millions of dollars out of domestic programs, even attacking Meals on Wheels, proposing to move that money over to the Pentagon. Just the other day, we had a massive approval of additional, you know, record spending for the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if this is what we get from the adults in the room, I would just suggest to you, we need a different set of adults.
Absolutely.
And so, yes, there are people who are more mature than others. No doubt about that. There are people who have more experience than Betsy DeVos, who shouldn't be anywhere near the Department of Education. But at the end of the day, there isn't a functional counterbalance to Trump's worst instincts and to the worst instincts of some of the other members of the cabinet and of these regulatory agencies. And the bottom line, Nicole, and you'll get this better than most people, the bottom line is that Donald Trump has empowered at the domestic level people who really want to apply radical neoliberal and austerity programs. And if they get away with it, they are going to privatize not just vast areas of our health care, but whole swaths of federal programs and initiatives. And the end result will be that we have the most powerful military that we've had in modern times, but a stunningly weakened domestic sphere in America, and overlaid with policies that are mainly oriented toward giving tax breaks to rich people.
Yeah.
It's a really bad, this is a very, very bad group of people. And I emphasize, Donald Trump doesn't wake up every morning and call every shot. He has empowered many of these people, and they are roaring down their track with very little oversight from Trump and very little oversight from Congress. And yet, if you watch him, and this is one of the things I emphasize in the book, if you watch him day to day, you are literally seeing programs get shut down, senior staffers leaving, a rendering of once functional agencies and regulatory bodies as dysfunctional. And this is, to my mind, as big a news story, as big a development as anything that Trump does.
You know, you mentioned Rex Tillerson basically shutting down the State Department. He, when he came in, he said his directive was to you know, cut the budget. But he has one undersecretary of state out of something like 15. He has one assistant, who was somebody who was a holdover from the Obama administration. I mean, there are multitudes of positions that have not been filled. And do you know, are they just not planning on filling them? Is this the goal, just to really make it so small you could drown it in a bathtub?
Well, I don't think they want to drown it in a bathtub. I think in general, what they're looking to do is have the legitimacy of these agencies, you know, the name, but not serving its traditional function. And so with Rex Tillerson, what I think you're seeing is a tremendous dismantling of and dialing down of the State Department. And as you do that, the State Department becomes a weaker entity. It still exists. It still puts its stamp of approval on policies and programs, but it does not serve the function that was intended. And you know, that's why I write about Rex Tillerson in the section of the book that deals with the military-industrial complex. Mm-hmm. Because to my mind, what Tillerson is doing is weakening the vehicles for diplomacy and aid, while Mulvaney and the generals are strengthening the vehicles for war.
Wow.
And, you know, it doesn't mean that they necessarily are going to give us a war, but they make it more likely by reducing the avenues by which we could have peace.
The book is Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. And we need to underscore the second part of the title, because they really are. This is a sad time for our country, and it's important to know what all these people are doing. This is a great tool for that. John Nichols of The Nation, it's always great to hear from you, my friend. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Nicole. Thanks so much.
You take care. Bye-bye. And with that, we are done for a Wednesday. As always, thank you for listening. Tomorrow, Howie Klein will be here, and my friend Laura Packard, who was blocked by the president on Twitter. No kidding. Some things just get curiouser and curiouser. We'll see you tomorrow. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on the Progressive Voices Network and NicoleSandler.com.